Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine, and for 1 week only, by Ben Dreyfuss of, like, Twitter and Substack, I guess. I don't know where we would describe you from these days, Ben. Thank you for being on the show today, Ben. Thank you for filling in for Alyssa.
Thank you for having me. And yeah, 1 week only. Unless, you know, look, maybe I'm never going to leave. That's just a threat.
I have ways to make
that's true.
Leave. It's okay. I'm not
maybe I
want to
leave. Maybe I'll leave right now.
All right. First up in controversies and non-controversies, Sinners is a huge hit, grossing nearly $50 million in its opening weekend domestically, garnering plaudits from audiences and critics alike. Warner Brothers took a risk greenlighting this R-rated original action horror movie, which cost something like $90 million. But it looks like that risk is going to pay off. Part of the risk is the unusual deal that writer-director Ryan Coogler struck with the studio that won them the project. In addition to a standard-ish, on the high end, but standard-ish, 20% of first dollar gross that big-time directors get, you know, Christopher Nolan gets this, Tarantino gets this, Coogler also negotiated to get the copyright for the film to revert to him 25 years from now. Now, this isn't unheard of. Quentin Tarantino negotiated a similar deal for 2019's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but it's exceedingly rare. Like, even Nolan doesn't get this. Over at Vulture, Chris Lee is reporting that studio apparatchiks are freaking out about it, with one exec saying, quote, "It could be the end of the studio system," end quote. Okay, that's a little bit of hyperbole, sure. Yes, it's true that much of the value of a studio is tied up in its library. These libraries generate enormous amounts of revenue by licensing the titles to cable channels, streaming services, etc. People rent them on VOD, right? You buy DVDs, you buy Blu-rays, etc., etc.
You do.
Every director were to get a deal like this, it could be pretty financially perilous for the studios, right? Here's the worst case scenario, as described by one anonymous studio executive, quote, "The lifetime long-term value of our film properties is what makes a studio a studio. It's why David Ellison wants to buy Paramount. It's how MGM sold for $8 billion. Things like licensing and windowing these films throw off hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars a year globally. So the whole idea of building up your library and you lose it in 25 years? Wait a second. You just gave up all your revenue down the line," end quote. And look, again, I'm going to come out in favor of the big guy here, right? Okay, I think it's worth acknowledging that the studios probably do deserve to have copyright on most movies in perpetuity. After all, they're the ones putting up tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in budgets and marketing, et cetera, to get the thing made in the first place, right? If Sinners flopped, if it had grossed $10 million this weekend, Ryan Coogler is not out there cutting a check to somebody to cover the studio's losses, right? Coogler is, again, he's getting 20% of first dollar gross. Gaining ownership a quarter century later is a nice cherry on top. But, you know, look, let's be honest here. One of the reasons WB is making this deal is that a quarter century from now, it is not entirely clear the WB will exist in the form it exists now, right? And it's also not clear that the revenue stream on any individual film is going to be particularly sizable. Between the collapse in the physical media market, the incredibly low number of older movies that services like Netflix license, and the relatively small amount of money it costs to rent these things and how little rentals are actually spent on older movies, again, any individual title, probably not worth that much money. Yes, libraries in the aggregate, very, very valuable. But any one individual title outside of something exceedingly rare, like a Godfather tier hit, just isn't going to be worth that much money, I don't think. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Peter, what do you make of Coogler's lucrative deal?
Well, Warner Brothers better start making the Sinners expanded universe and spinning off Sinners into like a whole franchise, not just of sequels, but of like sidequels and prequels and toys and animated cartoons, because they've only got 25 years to do it. And, you know, if they don't do that now, then they're not going to be able to like really strip mine this thing for all that it's worth. I just think I'm kidding, obviously. Sort of. Maybe they should make a Sinners kids cartoon.
Well, I mean, you do bring up an interesting point. Like, does it extend it? If they make a sequel, does it push the 20? Do they keep doing it just to keep the IP?
Right. So this is a question that we actually don't even know the answer to, is if you make derivative IP that is not, say, Coogler's original idea, right? Does that confer to Coogler? I would assume that he has some sort of stake in that sort of thing, but not necessarily ownership. And we don't know here. And it's just, I kind of think the idea that this is going to be the end of the studio system seems mostly wrong to me. And it seems mostly wrong because the studio system might end, but not because of this. It's going to end because Warner Brothers can't manage HBO Max without turning it into the Dr. Pimple Popper streamer, right? It's going to end because nobody's going to see movies in theaters unless they're gigantic, you know, franchise tentpoles. And even then, you're just looking at declines and declines and declines. A movie like this, like Sinners, which, yes, did overperform, if it was an overperforming version of this movie in 1995 or even 2005, would have just been like, we're rolling in it. And people are looking at this and saying, well, it's done better than The Tracking did, right? Showed us, right? It's probably going to earn out and make a bunch of money. So I just think studios are in trouble in a bunch of ways. And one of the ways they are in trouble that I've talked about before on this show is they're not just competing sort of in the traditional market for feature films by auteurist directors, big budget movies, that sort of thing. Movie studios are now competing not only with streaming, via Max and Disney Plus and Netflix. Movie studios are also competing with YouTube. And the next Ryan Coogler, or the Ryan Cooglers of 5 to 10 years from now, you know, Ryan Coogler, we should remember, is I don't think he's 40 yet. He's pretty young. Right. He made Fruitvale Station when I think he was like 25 or 27, something like that. If he's 40, he's 42 at oldest. Right. The next Ryan Coogler to come up and make a big name for him or herself in his or her late 20s or early 30s as a filmmaker of some sort, I think those people have a good chance of moving through YouTube and through the self-financed, self-distributed, or sort of quasi-self-financed and self-distributed systems that exist, not just kind of outside the studio system, but completely unrelated to it. Because if you do that, right, you can now go and make these things using cameras and distribution technology that you just don't need to, you don't need the studio apparatus anymore to make this stuff in a way that's much more true even than it was in the early 90s with the dawn of the Steven Soderbergh, you know, sort of indie revolution. And so and those people are going to own all of their property outright. We're probably going to see a wave of big name directors get more and more rights to their work over the next 10 years. I don't think that's going to kill the studios. I think other market forces and competition are much more likely to do so.
Your faith in the ability of YouTube to create something better than Mr. Beast is admirable, Peter, but I think probably misplaced. The point here that the studio execs are making, and I don't think it's wrong exactly, is a sort of slippery slope argument, right? It's like, We don't want to give this away to anyone, because the first person we give it away to, everybody's going to ask for it. And again, on an individual level, you know, it's not that big a deal. In the aggregate, it can start to be a big deal. Ben, the thing I worry about, frankly, with this is that it's just going to increase reliance on IP, because a Ryan Coogler movie, you know, he may be able to say, well, I should have the rights to this because I'm the writer and the director, I'm the auteur, I should get it. But if you're just making another Batman movie, if you're making another Superman movie, another Minecraft movie, you're never going to get those rights because the underlying rights are owned by somebody else.
I agree with you 100% that actually, I'm in the studio side here. I know that we're not supposed to say that because we're supposed to all be pro-creator, but it's not terribly clear to me why we're supposed to want the directors and screenwriters and creators of these shows to have their own property back after a few decades. I mean, if they make them and they're crap, they'll bomb and no one will see them. And if they make a small amount of money, which is what's going to happen here, then it'll just be a thing that'll be, you know, he'll make $50 million instead of $42 million, which means nothing to me. But when you talk about what it's comparing to, right, these IP competitions, it's like studios aren't just competing against streaming anymore and television. They're competing against YouTube, like I said, Peter. But they're also like competing against something called video games, which are an interesting example, because the creators of video games own nothing. You know, the guy who created The Last of Us, and the second one, Neil Druckmann. Those are two massive, massive things that he created, wrote, partially directed, did all of these things. They made $1 billion in the end or something like that. And he owns exactly zero IP to that. He will, in the end, almost certainly make more money from the HBO show based on it that he is a creator of than the actual video games itself. Because it's just a completely different industry. And it hasn't sort of like, it doesn't have all these protections for this authorial and autorial view of all of this. I understand why Ryan Coogler wants to own his movie. And I understand why other directors want to own their movies. But as a person who goes to movies, my main interest is that there's a vibrant studio system alive to fund the risks and take losses on 9 out of 10 of them. And I think that, like, in 25 years, whatever version of these studios exists will be using, they'll be still be, you know, squeezing out the last little bits of money from these libraries. And they're going to need it because I'm going to want them to be able to take a risk on Lethal Weapon 7.
Lethal Weapon Reboot Part 3.
Super stoked for a digitally de-aged Mel Gibson, right? To be, you know, played by an AI voice of him. It's going to take you back.
I don't want to harp too much on the IP angle here, but like the thing I do worry about is that I assume that most creators are not going to be able to argue for this sort of thing. And as long as they're working in IP stuff anyway, like Greta Gerwig's not going to get, you know, the copyright to her Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe movie or Barbie, right? That's just not going to happen.
So let me make a counter argument real quick here, is that maybe this encourages filmmakers to do just sort of IP cash grabs on IP that there's no way they'll ever own because it's a big global brand. But maybe if filmmakers see that they can get a stake in their own work, they will, like ambitious filmmakers will work harder to pitch stuff through the system that is their own original product.
Well, my argument is the studios themselves are just not going to want to spend, you know, the amount of money it would take to get that stuff made if they're just going to lose access to it in 20, 25, 30 years or whatever anyway. And again, like, this is such a niche level of film director working today, right? Like, we're talking about something that Tarantino and Ryan Coogler have done. Like, this is not a thing I think that most filmmakers really need to worry about being able to pull off, just because they don't have that sort of power and that pull.
Also, I mean, one other fact about it is, if those New York Times stories are right, that this is going to eat into their long-term profits, then it's actually going to disincentivize them from doing it again. Like this has made a lot of money. Sinners has made a lot of money, but it isn't going to make $1 billion. It's not going to be some huge profit windfall that's going to change Warner Brothers' stock price, which means it was probably a good gamble, but like, if they're only going to end up walking away with $10 million from it, it might mean that they say, oh, because it's like having, remember how Paramount made that deal with Tom Cruise so that he was actually making more money from Mission Impossible than they were? And they were like, it's just not worth it for us to do these movies right now. So it's interesting to see how that'll play out too.
I don't know. I think there are levels and levels here, right? Like, I think if a filmmaker finances the film himself, should absolutely retain control of it, rights to it, et cetera, et cetera. You know, this is what Francis Ford Coppola has done, right? He has been making his own movies. He holds the rights to most of them, and good for him. But I do, you know, again, I like the idea that Warner Brothers should just be happy to spend $150 million on this thing after budget and marketing, et cetera, and be like, okay, now it's yours in 25 years. Like, I find that, I don't know. It doesn't strike me as fair.
Let me make a counter argument real quick, which is just that, to the extent that the studio is providing guidance, support, equipment, locations, right, all of the kind of infrastructure to make this art, I kind of agree. At the same time, with something like Sinners, this is not just that Coogler was hired on to make this. This was his original idea that he brought to them. And like, in the same way that you might bring like an idea for a business to a bank and you take out a loan, right? And you set up that business, and then it's yours. You have to pay.
You pay the bank back.
Yes.
You pay the bank the loan back. It's not the same thing at all.
And no one is suggesting that Sinners is not going to pay back Warner Brothers here. What they're right, like Warner Brothers is going to make
money.
Coogler
isn't paying back Warner Brothers. Coogler's getting, not only is Coogler not paying back Warner Brothers, he's getting 20% of the first dollar gross. So he's got his hand in the till first.
It's not exactly the same, but it is. But to the extent that that studios end up doing less and less for these filmmakers and becoming, and this is why I'm trying to say, if your point is it's just the money, then they end up being much more like a bank. If it's the whole studio infrastructure, which guides a project and sort of brings it from this is an idea that maybe somebody scribbled on paper into the real world, then that's a somewhat different thing. And that isn't a big part of the value that studios add here. But I think, part of what we're going to see in the future is that the value add of studios, of having that big production infrastructure and even the distribution and marketing, is just going to decline. And we've already seen that. We've had many episodes on this podcast where we have griped about how nobody sees movie trailers anymore because the marketing aspect, even though they're spending huge amounts of money, the marketing is just not reaching people.
But also, you saw, on the other hand, you saw a lot of these Silicon Valley tech companies that tried to be like, we'll just throw money at the problem and we'll just do it. And then you have Apple and Amazon losing tens of billions of dollars because they actually didn't have the institutional knowledge that came with studios. And now that they're trying to rectify that, obviously. But I think there's still something to be said for the infrastructural part of it that you're talking about, the brain.
And this is what I'm saying. I think that has value. I think it is going to decline in value, is declining in value, and 10 or 15 or 25 years from now is probably going to be a lot less valuable unless things really change and studios figure out some other business model where they sort of have an advantage over some of these more homebrewed kind of online distribution systems.
I'm just excited for 25 years from now when Ryan Coogler is doing the Kevin Smith tour style events for Sinners, just taking it to the road show, going to show it on IMAX 70 millimeter at the 10 locations you can see it at. That'll be fun. And look, again, Smith is a perfect example of a guy who financed a lot of his own movies and kind of maintains control over a number of them. Most recently, I think he got the rights back to Dogma, which had been financed by the Weinsteins, was in kind of rights hell for a while. It's not that it doesn't happen. I just, also Dogma didn't cost $90 million.
But Coppola's a good example, right? He lost so much money with that one movie that his studio closed down. He had to sell it and then make Godfather Part III. He actually was funding it to the point of he was putting his skin in the game, and it, there was something to be said for that. He just lost however hundred zillions of dollars on that other movie last year. Have to make new wine.
Megalopolis. It's one of the year's best movies. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Ryan Coogler will retain or have ownership revert back to him in 25 years? Ben?
Not a controversy, really.
So a non-controversy.
A non-controversy. I didn't want to say it.
That's what we say on the show. We say controversy or non-controversy.
Non-controversy.
Peter.
It's interesting, but I don't think it's controversial. It's a non-controversy.
Controversy. Absolutely a controversy. This is opening the floodgates. No. The studio system is over. Life as we know it is ending.
That's true, but not because of this movie.
No, it's AI pornography that's going to do it.
Hi. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode on vampire movies. We're going to be doing a vampire movie draft. Everybody loves movie drafts. That's my understanding. It's the whole podcast empire is built on movie drafts. We're going to do one. All right. Now on to the main event. Sinners, written and directed by Ryan Coogler of Black Panther and Creed fame. Sinners is a big, bold, entertaining, slightly messy movie. It's a rumination on racism and cultural appropriation with a vampiric tinge. Lots of fun. People in my audience loved it. Michael B. Jordan, who played Killmonger in Black Panther and Adonis Creed in Creed for Coogler, reteams with the director in what might be his most entertaining role yet. He's playing gangster twins Smoke and Stack, who have returned to their Mississippi Delta hometown after fighting in World War I and spending some time in the employ of Al Capone up in Chicago. They've come back with pockets full of cash and trucks full of liquor and beer and wine, which is tough to come by. Amid Prohibition-era restrictions on alcohol, this movie takes place in 1932. Prohibition would end a year later. And they want to open a black-friendly juke joint. The big draw will be the vocal stylings and the guitar work of their cousin Sammy, who's played by Miles Keaton. He's got a voice so pure he can wake the dead, literally, as we learn in a brief prologue at the beginning of the film. Right, there are some folks who are just so good, who have voices so pure that their singing can bring everybody back from the ancestral plane into our world, right? Reuniting the living and the dead, healing the sick, getting people all happy and hot and bothered, and also occasionally inviting in some unwanted elements, like vampires, such as Remick, who's played by Jack O'Connell, who delivers the second best performance in this film as a sort of demented lord of the dance, right? He's an Irish ghoul who wants to absorb Sammy's essence in order to reunite with his own ancestors, from whom his vampiric curse has forever separated. When I say reunite, I mean this, like, literally. The signature set piece in Sinners takes place when Sammy is singing, and what we see is a sort of cinematic representation of art as an idea, right? Art as a continuum, art spanning the generations, from the tribal priests in Africa to the DJs spinning records in Brooklyn in the 1980s. In my review, I compared it to, like, it's like if Charles Dickens took all of the ghosts, past, present, and future from, like, every adaptation of A Christmas Carol and put them all in the same room at one of the annual Christmas parties to show us the kind of breaks and continuities of how that story has shaped and evolved and been told and retold over the centuries. Centuries? Yeah, sure. This is a movie about music and the power of music as much as it is anything else, right? The power of music to unite people through time and space, but also the power of music to kind of keep communities separate. It's not a stretch here to say that Coogler sees cultural appropriation as sort of a cultural vampirism, right? You see this play out in the way the music is actually deployed in the movie, right? After Remick turns some of the juke joint's partiers into vampires, his own Riverdance style music takes on a hipper edge, right? It has a faster beat. It has more bass. The actual aspect ratio of the screen stretches out. You can see everything more and more clearly. There's a sinisterness to what he has done here. And there's more heart to it, but it lacks the real, as they describe the music at the end of the film. It lacks the real of Sammy's blues. One last thing, I really want to emphasize how crowd pleasing this movie is. It's one of the, like, most purely crowd pleasing movies I've seen in some time. There's a sequence at the end that is at best kind of unnecessary, and at worst doesn't really make much sense. I'm sure we'll get into it in a minute. I don't want to spoil it just yet. But it is so purely calibrated to send audiences out of the theater cheering that I knew without a doubt this movie was going to get an A from CinemaScore audiences, which is something that has literally never happened for a horror movie before. Like, never. No horror movie has gotten an A. Some have gotten A minuses, but none have gotten a proper A. And now we can argue whether or not this qualifies as horror rather than action, you know, something else. But the point is, it is killing with audiences. The box office holds are spectacular. This movie's going to make a ton of money, at least domestically in America. It's just a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. Ben, you saw this movie in what I believe is the whitest part of the entire country, the backwoods of Idaho. Did your audience love it too?
Well, as you guys saw in the photos, there was literally no one else in the theater but me. But having said that, it was a mid.
So the question is, the question then is, did you love it because you were the audience?
It was me, and I did enjoy it. I thought it was pretty good. Coogler is a wonderful director. He's been great in, you know, everything from Fruitvale Station to the Creed movies, and, like, I think that he brings sort of a cinematic panache to it that carries it along more than I would actually say that the story itself would be if maybe with a lesser director, if he'd written it and handed it off. And I thought that the performances were great. I don't know that I think it's a movie that changes my life and understanding of music and how race relations in America. But I do think that it is firmly like an A movie.
When you you saw it on like a regular theater, right? Not IMAX, or you know, you saw it in the regular theater. It's interesting because so I saw it at IMAX. I saw it in IMAX, like regular standard kind of multiplex IMAX. He does the thing that Nolan does with his aspect ratios, where he's kind of shifting from scene to scene and shot to shot, which is always that it always bothers me when Nolan does it, and it bothered me a little bit here. But he also Coogler also does it in a way that feels a little more natural, more purposeful, frankly. Like I was mentioning, that sequence where the evil river dance happens, like the aspect ratio, it like changes on, it doesn't just go from like, whatever, 2.3 to 1 to 1.7 to 1 or whatever the numbers are. It stretches out on the screen. It expands like within the image itself, which I always like. That's a neat little trick and tick, and it really emphasizes just how much attention you're supposed to pay to this sequence. And Coogler has talked about how much he loves shooting with the IMAX 65 millimeter film, whatever. Peter, how did you see it? Did you see it in IMAX? Or
I saw this on a PLF, a premium large format that was not IMAX. I saw it on the Alamo's Big Show screen, which is the biggest non-IMAX screen in the Washington, D.C. area, or at least inside Washington, D.C. So it was a big screen, and I did not notice the aspect ratio shifts. I'm not even sure that they happened. I noticed that it was in a fairly, like a quite wide ratio in the opening, but maybe it happened and I was so immersed in the movie that I just missed it. That is a possibility. I saw it on big screen on an afternoon show. It wasn't packed, but it was probably about half full in the middle of the day, which was, I think, notable. The audience loved it. I liked this movie, and the more I think about it, the more I like it. This is one that is sort of built up in my head over time here. Part of it is just the excellent pacing of this, right? So this movie doesn't get to the vampire stuff until considerably over an hour into the 2-hour and 20-minute runtime. It's a vampire movie that doesn't really have vampires in it for the first half. There's like one, maybe two scenes that sort of foreshadow the vampires coming, including this absolutely great bit that ends in this like almost, I don't know, like a parody of like a 1960s horror movie Scream, as the camera like pulls up and shows you the full moon, and it's like, oh, that's where all this is going. But even then, it still takes like another 35 minutes before the vampires really start vampiring. Instead, what you get from that first hour or so is basically the Seven Samurai, but for a Jim Crow juke joint. And it's just like bumming around, picking up all of these characters, and each one of them gets a great like 7 to 10 minute sequence scene, right? Like, and so you're learning about all of these people, and there's a way in, like, you can imagine that being boring. You can imagine a vampire movie that doesn't have any vampires until the second half just being like, this is like, what are we doing here? Let's get to that. And it's not, because he gets these great, like, as you said, crowd pleasing, but kind of nuanced without being like, I don't know, we're going to make an indie art movie kind of character. Like these, they are big screen character studies of the kind that you used to see very commonly in the first act of movies and rarely see now. We actually just get to be with these characters and live with them in their world while also seeing why they're being brought into this story. And so when stuff starts to happen, you have a connection with them. You have made like you've drawn a little bit, you know, sort of what they're about and understood them psychologically, and also just sort of their physical capabilities and like just all of these different quirks about them once the action starts going. And that's the sort of stuff that in 1986, every script executive in Hollywood was like, would have been like, the movie needs to establish who these people are before you throw them into stuff. And they don't do that anymore. It's now just like, we got to get that action beat for the first 15 minutes, and then we got to get the plot going, and then we'll have some more action, and then you got to have the bigger action sequence at the end of the second act that leads to the moment where they're like, man, what are we going to do? And then the whole third act is also action. And I kind of like that sometimes. I like a good action sequence and like a propulsive movie, but this movie is methodical and incredibly well-paced without being slow or boring at all. And like, and by it just remembers that when you've got great actors and you give them one great scene, not even a great scene necessarily, a pretty good scene one pretty good scene that establishes who they are and what their world is like. That goes so far in building audience trust, drawing the audience in, and it lets your actors shine. The actors love that shit, right? Like, they're happy to do that.
The thing the movie reminded me of the most in that first hour or so is actually a heist film. It felt like a heist film.
That's right.
Where we're getting
a little bit of
together.
Ocean's 11.
We got a job to do. Yeah. Everybody's got one specific job to do. We need cornbread on the front door, keeping guard. We need Delroy Lindo playing piano. We didn't even mention Delroy Lindo, who's fantastic in this movie.
This is where I was about to go, is that of those opening bits, Delroy Lindo's is the best, and it steals, he steals every scene he is in. He is, as he always does, he is, I think, you said, I'm sorry, the guy who plays Remick was the second best performance in this movie. I disagree. This is Michael B. Jordan's film, very clearly, playing two characters in nearly every, frame and, scene of this movie, but Delroy Lindo is the one who stands out of the universally excellent supporting cast. Delroy Lindo is the one who just sort of like, I would happily go back and watch, as dumb as my idea for a Sinners prequel was, like just a Delroy Lindo movie in which he's just like getting drunk and playing the harmonica. And I don't know, maybe there's some vampires in the background. And he's like, ah, it's a crazy world we live in. Happy to watch that.
That was one of the most exciting names on the cast list. Like when we talked about this a few weeks ago about me going to even see this, I was like, Delroy Lindo, because he's made an entire career out of doing exactly what we're talking about. And I mean, yeah, he nails it. It's wonderful. The Irish guy's good too, though.
They're all good. This is the thing, is like, when I say that I think Delroy Lindo is the second best performance in this movie, it's not at the expense of the others. It's just that this is Michael B. Jordan at, close to his best, if not his best, and Delroy Lindo just as good as he always is, which is always wonderful. And then there's that scene in the middle, with where like the juke joint opens up and becomes, as you said, this kind of sprawling intertemporal like literalization of Black art and Black music, and like the way it sort of transfers and passes through time and connects to people. And that scene should not work. Like, if I just described it to you, it's the idea of it sounds kind of cheesy as hell. And oh my, it works like gangbusters. It is incredible. Like, it's the most interesting thing I have seen on screen, certainly in the calendar year 2025. But, like, just sort of like as a singular, like, not forget like the whole film, but like as a specific piece of filmmaking, especially inside a movie that carries a major studio logo at the front, like, you just don't see stuff like this anymore. That is a big swing. That is a big risk. I think Coogler has to know that a scene like that could come off as a little bit cheesy, a little bit off-putting to audiences who are like, what, magical guitars? Why is there a DJ? And right, like, this is... He's not making this movie just for kind of cinephile sophisticates. He's making this to be a crowd pleasing film, and it works. And I've been thinking about that. Like, I'm trying to figure out exactly why that bit works so well. And part of it is that the music is so great. And this is, I think that is an original song that Sammy is playing there, original to this film. Is that correct? Do you guys know?
I believe it's an original, yeah.
And that's part of what makes this work, is that, like, you see this on the page and you're like, I don't know. You got to have an incredible song there, and you got to have it sung incredibly well. And then the blending of all these other elements has to work really seamlessly. And the music in this film is uniformly excellent and just like way above par for a studio film. And sort of thinking about like having that song actually work on its own terms and actually be the moving experience that it needs to be inside the film, that's pretty impressive. I really like that. And then, of course, after that, right, we get this final 50-minute stretch or so, which, yes, has these codas, but like for the bulk of the end of the movie, it's amazing how much this movie resembles Jim Crow era take on From Dusk Till Dawn. right? This is just from like From Dusk Till Dawn, like a weird little movie that, like, yes, has its fans, but like it was a Quentin Tarantino script. Robert Rodriguez directed. George Clooney, I think it was his first feature film, but certainly very early in his career before he was understood to be a movie star. He was just the ER hunk at that point. It's this crazy, pulpy, sort of silly thing that's also really good on its own terms, and also doesn't have the vampires show up till an hour into the 2-hour movie. But it's the siege in From Dusk Till Dawn and the siege in this movie are staged in ways that like really mirror each other in a lot of ways. And I just thought that was hilarious. Like he's taking like one of the great trash films. And I do mean that it's great and also that it's trashy of the last 30 years and adapting it into this much more accessible, much more like in some ways, more thoughtful, right, statement about like race relations and all that, but fundamentally this is a vampire siege film and it's basically just Jim Crow from Dusk Till Dawn. Like, again, this is sort of insane. If somebody described this to you, you'd be like, that's not gonna work. Works like hell. I loved it. I was very happy.
The part that they spent so much time for establishing that the universe and sort of like the bona fides, yeah, for what they're doing in that first hour plus wherever it is, and then with that wonderful sequence which is so, you know, out of the blue, kind of. Then when they, I think it's like the immediate next scene is when the Irish vampires show up and there's like 10 yep. minutes of them having this incredibly like tense, are they going to get in and are they not going to, before we then get into the siege. And actually like those 10 minutes are probably my favorite part of the film as they're transitioning from that into this then full on the action part of it. Because as a viewer, you're still trying to like, your mind is still catching up sort of to like the genre bending that's about to happen. And you know, there's this sense of like, you know, foreboding that's going on and you don't know exactly how it's going to happen, but then it does. And I thought that little stretch, the transition that they then pull off so well, because then it's so propulsive after that. And it turns into this, you know, bullet for the last hour or whatever it is, that it really just shows his ability to like, not only just like play with genres, but then to play with them so smoothly that someone who's a fan of one part isn't going to be totally pissed off by the part that then they're moving into a genre they're not as familiar with.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very fluid film, and the way I do think describing this as a horror movie is a slight cheat. It's not really a horror movie. It's an action movie with some horror elements in it.
It's a vampire siege film. This is a very specific little genre that may include some movies that don't technically have vampires. I mean, but it's like, it's actually also really resembles some of the Romero zombie films, the early ones, right? Like the Dawn of the Dead, the 1970s Romero version of it is just a siege film in a mall with the zombies surrounding you and trying to figure out what to do, right? And then eventually they get in and there's things go down. But this is a horror monster siege movie.
Okay. I mean, again, not really a horror movie.
It's not terribly scary.
It's not scary, is it?
We should say for our sensitive listeners, it's kind of gory. It's quite gory.
Yeah, it is also has some funny moments. I mean, that moment.
It's hilarious. It's often very funny.
The Irish guys, they did have some moments of like jumping out and playing the banjo and weird, where I actually genuinely was laughing out loud, that helps break some of the tension.
But even that bit up at the very beginning of the movie, when you first meet Smoke and Stack in the factory that they're buying that becomes the juke joint, it's like, nah, he's my cousin, right? Yeah. Like, he's like this little, like, just this, you're immediately defining who these two different Michael B. Jordan characters are, right? Like, they have this slyness to them. Like, they are, and Jordan is just enjoying the hell out of it, clearly, playing these two parts. One, the sort of more serious and soulful guy, and the other one, the sort of, you know, confident, gunslinger, whatever we want to call him, right? But somebody with a little bit more swagger. And the interplay just between Michael B. Jordan's characters, the two people he plays, is quite funny.
All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Sinners? Ben?
Thumbs up. I do think that maybe like some of the rapturous acclaim that it is the best film ever made is a little over the top, but and not from this panel here, but like there has been some of that going around here in the universe the last week. And I think that's a little like pump the brakes, honey, but I do think it's definitely enthusiastic thumbs up.
That's fair. Peter.
It's a little uneven at times. And I should say, like, I think it's sort of, there are so many ideas at work here and not all of them kind of perfectly weave together. And the final maybe 10 minutes or so is a little bit, you said it was sort of put together to designed to leave the crowd cheering. And I get that, but I think it's sort of can't quite figure out where its ending is and what that ending needs to be. But this is a good movie. This is the, I mean, this is just a good big budget rockin' action film. And I enjoyed it a lot. Thumbs up.
Yeah, thumbs up. And I totally agree. There are lots of different plot points one could nitpick about this, you know, threads that get kind of mentioned and then left aside. I do think we could get a whole prequel movie out of the Native American trackers who we see chasing Remick down at that weird, again, that brief scene about 40 minutes in where, like, that really should have been a prologue maybe, instead of the voiceover where we learn about the magic of the music or whatever, but whatever, neither here nor there.
This movie has two prologues also.
Yeah.
Lots of the prologues. Animated explain the magic prologue. There's, and then this slow moving thing where Sammy shows up at the church the day after the siege and you don't know exactly what's happened, but boy, he's been through it. Some bad stuff. He's got to repent.
Some structural
and two
stuff
epilogues
in there that could be. And two epilogues.
Yeah.
Yep. Anyway. There, it's just a lot of movie, but people love it. Big hit. Thumbs up for me. I'm a fan. It's a lot of fun. And I hope folks check it out because it's good to have nice, big, original movies do well in the movie theater. You love to see it. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Rupert Manderstam, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Ben's going to be sticking around for that one as well. So we'll have him for one more episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.